You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 117, Ezekiel chapters 8 and 9. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good. Very good, Trey. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good.
Things are normal.
Things are normal, and we're moving right along through Ezekiel. You know, it's funny that I'm starting to see the name Ezekiel everywhere, in football, on TV.
Well, speaking of football, how did you do on the first week?
Yeah, I don't think I had anybody on the first night, so remains to be seen on Sunday. But
did you draft Ezekiel Elliott?
Of course I did.
Okay. So that's right. I called you a homer during the draft. That's right.
That's right. And you're a homer as well for taking a Packer. So
yeah, well, you take. We want to win. Yeah, I took Eddie Lacy.
So we're both homers here, but I'm an Ezekiel homer, I guess. So this podcast gives me the win, I guess. We don't play each other until like a long time, like week 8 or something.
So I didn't look ahead. I wonder where we'll be 8 weeks from now.
But we got a long way to go before we start trash talking. So,
yeah. Okay. Well, when we get to that point, I'm sure you'll be desperate for a win. It's just too bad.
We shall see.
Yep. All right. Well, let's jump in here to Ezekiel 8. Again, just to sort of get a little bit of context for this. We're doing 8 and 9 today, and these chapters fall into a pretty significant section of the book. Chapters 8 through 11 really concern two themes, and that is these are visions of punishment for Jerusalem, the people of Jerusalem, but the section also deals with the circumstances that lead to the departure from the temple of the glory of God. And that, again, that's a big theme in Ezekiel, the loss of the glory, which of course naturally would coincide with the destruction of the temple. But the second one, a lot of people have sort of heard about, it's kind of famous, the Ichabod passage, the glory has departed, we're not there yet. But this is the section in which that's going to happen, chapters 8 through 11. Now, listeners will recall that Ezekiel 4 and 5 had been sign acts. Ezekiel doing, for lack of a better term, dramatizations, visualizations of this impending punishment of Judah and, the city of Jerusalem and, of course, the temple. So now we're getting into not sign acts describing this, but visions that Ezekiel has. So the object, the target, sort of the theme is the same, but this is kind of a different experience for Ezekiel and a different delivery, of the same kind of message. Now, in chapter 8, we're going to be getting into some specifics about the idolatries that are being punished. So Ezekiel 8 is going to add details to what we covered in Ezekiel 6. Remember, the big theme in Ezekiel 6 is, why is God doing all this stuff to us? And the answer is, because you're idolaters. And specifically, what was kind of in the crosshairs there was state-sponsored idolatry there in chapter 6. So we're going to get some more specifics about what all that concerned. And then chapter 9, we're going to get this vision of divine executioners sent by God. Again, it's sort of a vision allegory of what is going to happen at the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, again, in this impending invasion and destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. So let's just begin. We'll read in Ezekiel 8. We'll just start there. I don't know that we'll read every verse of both passages, but we'll read a lot of them. So let's just go to Ezekiel 8:1. It says, in the sixth year, in the sixth month, on the fifth day of the month, just pause there. That would be, if you're keeping track of the chronology and the dates, that would be roughly 14 months after the initial vision of chapter 1. So in the sixth year, the sixth month, the fifth day of the month, the hand of the Lord God fell upon me there. As I sat, my house, the hand of the Lord. you know, fell upon me there. He's with, in chapter, in verse 1, the elders of Judah. Again, this is going to be a different group than the elders that are mentioned later, but back to the text here. So sitting there with the elders, hand of the Lord comes upon me. In verse 2, then I looked, and behold, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire, and above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness, like gleaming metal. Now that should sound familiar. Let's just pause there. That's language drawn from Ezekiel chapter 1. Except in this case, we're not going to get the wheels and the throne and the fire, you know, fiery throne, all that stuff. We get, again, a form that had the appearance of a man. Below what appeared to be his waist was fire, and above his waist was something like the appearance of brightness, like gleaming metal, again, this very radiant thing. Verse 3, he put out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the gateway of the inner court that faces north, where was the seat of the image of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the vision that I saw in the valley. Now, let's just stop there. If you've heard my lecture on the two powers in heaven, this is a passage that I will often reference in regard to how two powers language is used in a passage where the Spirit becomes one of the figures, you know, in that passage. So the Spirit gets drawn into or described through the use of two powers language. And you say, well, I'm not following, Mike. Well, here's what I mean. Now look at the terminology. Verse 2. Then I looked and behold a form that had the appearance of a man. Okay, so Ezekiel's sitting there, he's in his hut, his house with these elders, and he sees the appearance of a man, and that below the waist was like fire, above the waist was something like the appearance of brightness. Again, language drawn from Ezekiel 1, so he's seeing the figure that he saw in Ezekiel 1, which we know, you know, from Ezekiel 1, that was the, it was referred to as both the glory, okay, the glory of God, and in chapter 10, which we haven't gotten there yet, but we've already mentioned it in conjunction with chapter 1, that figure was also called the God of Israel. So again, we have this, as we talked in chapter 1, we have this anthropomorphized language about the God of Israel. Okay, well, that fine. We've been there before. We've seen that. But then in verse 3, he, apparently this man, okay, the form of a man, the anthropomorphized God of Israel, put out the form of a hand and took me by a lock of my head. So again, more anthropomorphic language. But then it says this, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Jerusalem. Now, here's where we get the Ruach entering into this. So the question is, well, who lifted him up? Was it the anthropomorphized man or was it the Spirit? And the waters get muddied even more because he's taken to a place and he says, the glory of the God of Israel was there, in the place that he was taken to. And you say, well, wait a minute. I thought it was already, you know, I thought you were already looking at it. And I thought that this anthropomorphized man who was called the glory in chapter 1 is the one picking you up. How can the one picking you up be the one you see in the place where you're transported? So the language here is not only two figures, apparently, but since we have the Ruach, the Spirit mentioned, again, this becomes Old Testament fodder for a three-person Godhead. Now, Ruach, of course, can mean wind. So you could say the wind lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in visions of God to Israel. But since this isn't a literal journey, this is a visionary experience. And again, because of some of the other things that are said about the Spirit, okay, the Spirit in the book of Ezekiel, most scholars very readily recognize that this is the divine Spirit either a divine spirit or the divine spirit, the spirit of God, whatever, and not just wind. So you, again, you've got this, looks like two figures, but the two are sort of confused as one. And then you have this introduction of a third. So who's lifting him up? How can he see the God of Israel in the place to which he's taken when the description used of the God of Israel for the one picking him up matches chapter one? I mean, who's the God of Israel in the picture? You know, is it the one picking him up, or is it the one that he sees when he gets there? Okay. And we grant, again, this is a vision. Visions aren't supposed to be precise. You know, they're not supposed to, you know, sort of observe the laws of, you know, physics and all this stuff. Again, you know, they're like dreams or whatever. But the issue is the language of the text. It's not, you know, that we can't sort of map this out in real space time kind of thing. You know, that isn't our problem. That really isn't the issue. The issue is the way this language is used of two or three beings again, and not only used, but they're blurred. The distinctions between them get blurred in places in this passage and in other passages too. So I just want to alert people to the fact that, again, here's a passage that becomes fodder for not only the two powers in heaven discussion that occurred, you know, in the Jewish context, you know, in ancient Judaism, at least prior to the second century AD, but it also becomes fodder for perhaps the Spirit of God is, you know, is a member, is like these other two, is to be identified with these other two. Again, this is just a glimpse of Old Testament stuff from which the doctrine of a Trinity will develop. Now, for those of you who have read Unseen Realm, you know, there's a lot more to this. You know, the human Yahweh, again, the Yahweh as a man in the Old Testament, becomes the focal point because of the incarnation of Jesus and what New Testament writers say about Jesus. And I've made the comment before that, you know, just as Jesus is but isn't God, the Spirit is but isn't Jesus to the New Testament writers. And I deal a lot with that in Unseen Realm. There are several places where the Spirit of God is, or the Spirit of the Lord is swapped out for the Spirit of Jesus. Two places where Paul says the Lord Jesus is the Spirit, you know, that kind of thing. So what the New Testament writers are doing is they're doing kind of what happens here in Ezekiel 8. They're using terminology that you could easily associate with two separate beings, one or the other, and then injecting the Spirit into the conversation. Again, in effect, this is where your Trinitarian thinking comes from. It doesn't, you know, it's not an invention. It's a repurposing and a reuse of Old Testament language. Now you have Jesus in the conversation for the New Testament writer. Again, the Trinity is not a new innovative contrivance. It's a repurposing of stuff in the Old Testament. Well, let's just, again, move beyond that, because that's pretty well-worn territory for at least the Naked Bible podcast crowd. We see mentioned here in verse 3 the image of jealousy. Okay, it's also going to be mentioned in verse 5. So I read through verse 4. Verse 4 said, "Behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there like the vision I saw in the valley." Verse 5, we read this. I'll read verses 5 and 6. It says, "Then he said to me, 'Son of man, lift up your eyes now toward the north.' So I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance was this image of jealousy. And he said to me, 'Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations that the house of Israel are committing here to drive me far from my sanctuary. But you will see still greater abominations.'" And that's verses 5 and 6. Now, let's talk about the image of jealousy a little bit. Again, it's kind of a natural point of curiosity, like, what is this thing? And I think there's a clue in verse 3. In verse 3, Ezekiel is brought to the inner court that faces north. And then in verse 5, of course, we read, "So I lifted up my eyes toward the north, and behold, north of the altar gate in the entrance was this image of jealousy." Now, Block, in his commentary, has a little note here, and he says, he notes that the Solomonic temple had two courts inside the inner and outer walls, respectively. The reference for that is 2 Kings 21:5 and 23:12. The gate of the inner court denotes the gateway through the inner wall by which access is gained to the courtyard surrounding the temple building itself. In verse 5, the gate in question is identified as the altar gate, presumably because the great altar of sacrifice was visible through this gate from the outer court. And that's the end of Bloch's statement. So if you are sort of either remembering or familiar with kind of a diagram of Solomon's temple, you can kind of orient yourself. But the key observation that we'll come back to here is that this image, whatever it was, is basically right at the altar. Okay, right at the entryway where the altar is. It's positioned somewhere in proximity to the altar. Now, the terminology itself for image of jealousy, the terminology is a little bit different here than your typical terminology for idols. We have the word image, at least the ESV translates it, image is semel, which again refers to again something sculpted. So that this term only occurs in two other places in the Hebrew Bible. Deuteronomy 4:16 is one of them, where we have the pesel temunat kol samel, which is roughly translated the sculpted form. Okay, sculpted form of every semel, okay, whatever that is. And in that verse, it refers to any image of a deity that would, again, be the object of Israelite devotion when it shouldn't be. So anything that would sort of, again, stand in the place of Yahweh, that was a carved image or a graven image or, you know, some sort of manufactured image, that's what Deuteronomy 4:16 is talking about. So it's kind of a generic reference. We get a little more specific, though, in the other occurrence of this, 2 Chronicles 33:7 and 15. So this is the other chapter. There's two chapters where this occurs. And this is in reference to Manasseh's abominable image, Manasseh's, you know, the thing that he, you know, created and installed there in the temple precinct, which 2 Kings 21:7 refers to as, it uses pasel, the pasel, but then it's followed by Ha-Asherah. And you could translate that as, you know, an idol, a graven image, a graven form of Asherah. And something engraved or carved is a better word for it. A carved form of Asherah. Now, Asherah is probably familiar to some people in the audience. Asherah was a goddess. In Canaanite religion, Asherah was we might use the word wife, but the consort, the sexual partner, some would say wife of El. And again, in Canaanite religion, El was, again, the highest deity. He's not really the one who runs the show. That's Baal. Baal turns out to be sort of the co-regent or the vizier, if you want to use that term of El. But El was sort of this father god figure, and Asherah becomes the mother goddess figure in Canaanite religion, because together, El and Asherah they give birth to 70 lesser gods. One of them is Baal, although there's, you know, Baal in other texts appears to be something of an outlier. Baal is also called the son of Dagon, and so there's this big scholarly discussion. Well, is El Dagon? Is Dagon El? Are they two different things? What's Dagon mean? And I'm not going to bother rabbit trailing there, but we've got here 70 lesser gods produced, procreated by El and Asherah. Baal is called, you know, the son of Asherah. Again, he's also called the son of Dagon, that sort of thing. So without rabbit trailing into that issue, we can see what Asherah is. She's a goddess. She's a female consort of El. Now, again, if you're an Israelite, El is both a generic term for deity, and El is a term that biblical writers are going to use of Yahweh of Israel. There are verses that say Yahweh is El, or Yahweh is Ha-El, the El. I mean, like the real El, the true El, you know, that sort of thing. So you have, again, you have a terminological issue going on here. You have an identification issue going on here. In terms of Orthodox Israelite thinking, Yahweh is the El. He is the true El, which means the other El or the other Ls are imposters. Okay. But it would be very easy, again, for an Israelite, especially if they were encouraged by a priest, to say, oh, well, Yahweh is just El, this El in Canaanite religion. So some of the stuff that the Canaanites do is okay. And one of the things that the Canaanites believe is that El has a wife. And so that's Asherah. So it's okay if we bring Asherah into the temple. You know, El would be okay with that. You know, Yahweh is El. Yahweh's okay with having a goddess here. You could see, again, the easy path that this took. And this is one of the things that the prophets are constantly harping on, distinguishing Yahweh from other Els, you know, other Elohim, other Els. Yeah, this is part of the problem. This is why they have to do it so often and with such force and with such frequency. So let's go back to Asherah and ask the obvious question. Well, was Manasseh's image, therefore, an image of this goddess, Asherah? Now, the image of Asherah could be, again, a sculpted goddess figure. There are things called Asherim in sanctuary or places, high places, that were not images of the goddess herself, but are poles. The Asherah pole, some English translations will have that for Asherim, which is it's not definite, but it's likely. It's probably a phallic symbol because Asherah, again, has to do with fertility, you know, that sort of thing. So Manasseh's image could be either an image of the goddess herself, you know, something that sort of looks humanoid, feminine, or more likely, probably an Asherah pole. So is this what Ezekiel's talking about? Now, Block and others, he's not alone here, says that, well, probably not, because Josiah, it's according to 2 Kings 23:6, Josiah had destroyed Manasseh's Asherah pole or Asherah figure from the temple. A part of Josiah's reformation was to get rid of this thing. Well, that, of course, is true. But there's actually other evidence that this image was indeed, you know, an image of Asherah. Whatever that was, is it a pole? Is it something that looks more identifiable as a goddess? That part we can't really know. But there's other image that does take this phrasing and link it to Asherah. So if that's the case, if that evidence is sound, we're going to talk a little bit about it in a moment. If that evidence is sound, then what this probably means, for the sake of the book of Ezekiel, is that sometime after Josiah tore this thing down, somebody put another one in there. They created another Asherah Semel, another Asherah image, and they installed it near the altar. So that could be what we're looking at. Now, what's the other evidence that here in Ezekiel we might be looking at an Asherah figure? Well, there are really four lines of evidence, and some of this is going to be familiar. Some of it's going to require the Hebrew alphabet. So for those who have a knowledge of the Hebrew alphabet, you'll get more out of this than those who don't, but I'm going to go through it real quickly anyway. There's four elements to this argument. One is the Septuagint. The Septuagint in this place in Ezekiel 8 doesn't read the image of jealousy. It reads the image of the buyer, which sounds really odd. Semel konah, or konah, the feminine form, would likely have been the Hebrew that produced the Septuagint translation, image of the buyer. Now, in the Masoretic text, image of jealousy is Semel HaKinah. You notice how they sound very similar. Septuagint guy, whoever the translator was, the text he was using, it looks like it read Semel Konah or Semel Konah. Q-N-H. That's the lemma for buying and acquiring. Whereas the Masoretic text, image of jealousy, would be Q-Kof-N-Nun-Aleph. And then possibly followed by a hey to vocalize it. So very, very similar spellings, but they are completely different words. Now here's the point. You have a text. And I should say this, to make things more complicated, the QN Aleph thing, you could have, again, the Aleph drop out and just use the hey on the ending for vocalization. That can happen too. It happens in Hebrew morphology and Hebrew manuscripts. So you could have two scribes either looking at slightly different words or the same set of consonants and drawing different conclusions about how to translate it. But the Septuagint has image of the buyer. So that's the first part of the evidence, the consonants. What consonants are there? And depending on what consonants you think might be there, which lemma, which Hebrew root, Hebrew word is that? Is it a word that means jealousy, or is it a word that means to acquire or buy? Second, again, to muddy the waters a little bit more, kana, the verb with that ends with the H, with the hey, to acquire or buy, can also mean create. Now, this is a well-known biblical lemma, biblical Hebrew word. It's controversial because this is the lemma that's used in Proverbs 8, specifically Proverbs 8:22. The ESV translates, "The Lord possessed me, the Lord kanaed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old." This is, of course, the chapter on Lady Wisdom. And again, if you go up to thedivinecounsel.com, there's a brief essay by me there about the relationship of Jesus to wisdom, because it's important, because Proverbs 8:22 portrays wisdom as a co-creator, someone who was there when God fashioned the world. And in some part of Proverbs 8, Proverbs 8:22 through, right around verse 30 or so, wisdom again is cast as sort of the agent of creation, someone who's there helping or again participating in the creation. Well, wisdom has some real interesting things, said about it in the Second Temple Jewish literature. Wisdom is part of the divine council. Wisdom is seated at the right hand of God, all this sort of thing. Now, Jews of the day, many of them thought that wisdom was sort of a code word for Torah. And there are Jews who actually believed and taught in the Second Temple period that the Torah was like a deity. The Torah was divine. The Torah was personified by this language. Of course, what others did was know that wisdom isn't the Torah. Wisdom is a second divine figure, part of the two powers in heaven thinking. And in the New Testament, wisdom gets applied to Jesus. And of course, the New Testament says that Jesus was the co-creator, so that would make sense. But what the problem is when you go back to Proverbs 8:22, you have this verb kana. And if you translate it create, well, then you have the co-creator being a created being. And of course, the New Testament denies this about Jesus. So we have a big theological discussion. Now, again, you can read the thing on thedivinecounsel.com, Jesus and Wisdom. Ultimately, kana can be translated other ways besides acquire or buy. It could be translated as possess. It could be translated as create. It could be translated as bring forth, because in Proverbs 8:22, it's used in parallel with other lemmas that mean to bring forth, which of course doesn't require a beginning point. It just requires the introduction of something or the unveiling of something, something made apparent that before was not apparent. And this was a huge part of the early Christological discussion, as you can imagine, in the early church. And again, you'll find out if you read the article on thedivinecounsel.com that create is not a very good translation in terms of the attributes of God, because if wisdom is an attribute of God, even though you want to argue it's personified, you can't have God creating wisdom as a co-creator because, well, didn't God have wisdom before that? How could you have God? How could you have the God of the Bible lacking wisdom? It doesn't make any sense. By definition, you wouldn't have the God of the Bible if he lacked wisdom. And how would he be smart enough to create it because he knew he would need it? He wouldn't know that because he wasn't wise. I mean, so create is really a problematic translation, which is why many people prefer something else. ESV has possessed here, for instance. Again, this was a focal point of early Christological discussion, but kana does not require create as a translation. Even if you wipe Jesus off the table, and the binitarian thing off the table, you're left with the problem of how God can lack wisdom. And that's a significant Jewish Old Testament theological problem. But let's take this back to Ezekiel. Let's say that the text read, again, the image, the semel, Q-N-H, Kof Nun He. And let's say that Kofnun He, Kana, can mean create. Now we have the image of the creator, if it's masculine. But if it's feminine, masculine would be Koneh in Hebrew pointing. You'd have a participle, a masculine participle. The feminine would be Kona. If it was feminine, you'd have the image of the creatress. And that is a clear reference to Asherah, because that's what she was. She was the creatress. So you either, the image of jealousy, again, what I'm suggesting is that might not be a really good way to read it. You might have to go with the Septuagint here and then translate it as the image of the creator or the image of the creatress. Either way, you have idolatry. You would have, if it's masculine, you'd have Israelites making a graven image of the God of Israel, which they're specifically commanded not to do. But since this language is used of Manasseh's Asherah image, a lot of scholars are going to say, look, the feminine would make sense here, the image of the creatress. And so what you're dealing with here in Ezekiel 8 is another image of Asherah. Again, whether it's her as a feminine form or a phallic symbol like the Asherah pole, we don't know. But I think, again, that's probably what we're looking at here. We have an Asherah image. And Block states, even though he doesn't want to go with the Asherah thing because of what happened with under Josiah, he says this, and I think it's a really good observation. He says, the position of this semel, this image, right at the altar, is, quote, overtly idolatrous and poses a direct challenge to Yahweh because it's at the atoning altar. I mean, what does that say about their theology? It doesn't say anything good. It says lots of bad things, okay? And then Ezekiel, right after, the people would have known what this was and would have been horrified if you're an Orthodox Israelite. Anyway, you're horrified by this. And Ezekiel says, but you're going to see still greater abominations. And you have to be thinking like, oh boy, what? Well, let's read verse 7. We'll jump back into verse 7 here. I'll read verses 7 to 11, Ezekiel 8. And he brought me to the entrance of the court. And when I looked, behold, there was a hole in the wall. Then he said to me, son of man, dig in the wall. So I dug in the wall, and behold, there was an entrance. And he said to me, go in and see the vile abominations that they are committing here. So I went in and saw. And there, engraved on the wall all around, was every form of creeping thing and loathsome beasts and all the idols of the house of Israel. And before them stood 70 men of the elders of the house of Israel. And the Hebrew there is men, the elders from the house of Israel, with Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them. Each had his censer in his hand, and the smoke of the cloud of incense went up. That's Ezekiel 8, 7 through 11. Now, because these elders are not limited to 70, but they come from the 70, scholars presume that this isn't a reference to the Sanhedrin, the early form of the Sanhedrin, but probably, more probably, a group representing lay, that is, non-priestly leaders in Jerusalem, political figures. And so here we go again, state-sponsored idolatry, state-sponsored, by the people who should know better. They're burning incense in the dark. It's described as his room of, this room of pictures. Each one has, is there in his room of pictures. Now the pictures, again, or these images, are going to correspond to the list of animals in verse 10. So I went in and saw, and they're engraved on the wall all around, was every form of creeping thing, loathsome beast, and all the idols of the house of Israel. So there's engravings of unclean things on the walls, and they're burning incense to them. Now, Taylor has a short commentary. This is part of the Tyndale Old Testament commentary series that comments on this. And I think, again, it's worth a quick read. Taylor writes this about this section. Engraved upon the walls in verse 10 is inadequate for a word meaning incised or carved in relief. Basically, they were reliefs, is what he's saying. They were all kinds of creeping things, loathsome beasts, idols. Creeping things, Hebrew remes, are specifically mentioned as part of God's good creation in Genesis 1:24. They're not by definition all unclean. I mean, just because it creeps doesn't mean it's unclean. As Leviticus 11:41 would suggest, for the word translated creeping things in that context is a different one. Okay, sherets. They do, however, include many reptiles, small verminous creatures that scurry and slither over the ground, from snakes to scorpions, and these certainly were unclean. The serpent deities known from Egyptian, Canaanite, and Babylonian religions give grounds for supposing that this incident reflects the widespread influence of foreign cults on Israelite worship, cultivated no doubt from political more than purely religious motives. Basically, that's the end of the quote. Basically, that's an allusion to alliances, political alliances, you know, again, allowing this sort of influence as some sort of positive goodwill political gesture within the context of Israel. So I read the quote again just to make the point that the language again suggests, like Taylor says, the widespread influence of other ancient Near Eastern cults. This is why there'd be certain, you know, specific unclean creeping things engraved in relief on the walls. So apart from the idolatry, you have also the issue of, again, alliances with these pagan states that themselves, you know, God was supposed to be their king. So that's a violation. But then again, the reason that you don't do that, one of the reasons, is not because you want to, not only because you want to show that you trust God, but also because you're going to be infected by what they believe. And sure enough, that's what you get here. Now, as far as the role of incense, again, I only bring this up because, and I'd have to look for it, it popped into my head here. I had a friend in graduate school in an Israelite religion seminar one time that did a paper on the role of incense in worship. It's really hard to find material on that. And, you know, if I can find it, it might be in his dissertation, and that probably means I can't post it. If I find his paper, then I could, but I'll give it a look because I could post that. But anyway, the bottom line here is that you used incense not only, as many commentators say, well, they used it in the tabernacle so you couldn't smell the animal stink. Well, okay, you know, that probably has something to do with it. But think of it this way. When you entered into sacred space, this is where you used incense. So you weren't depending on the incense cloud to filter outside the tabernacle where they were killing the animals and burning them and the animal poop and all this stuff. Again, that's a residual effect. But that isn't why you did it. You used incense in sacred space for a very simple reason. It marked that space different than other space. In other words, you couldn't just walk around the Israelite camp or the city of Jerusalem and smell incense. When you smelled incense, it was a clue to your senses. It should have been a clue to your brain that, oh, okay, that this is divine territory. This is divine turf, you know, because this is where this is burnt on holy ground, sacred ground. It distinguished the place from other places. And again, that's a really important part of the logic of why you would use incense to distinguish the sacred from the profane, from the normal. And we spent a lot of time on this in Ezekiel, you know, talking about how these distinctions were made. Incense is part of that. So if you take that back to Ezekiel, what do you have? You have Israelites burning incense to these unclean figures carved on the walls, and the connotation was, these are our gods. They are sacred. We are marking out space for them, as though the space they occupy is holy and sanctified and sacred. And of course, for Ezekiel, this is just abominable. And again, if you're the reader and you're, again, an Orthodox Israelite, you're thinking, this is horrible. So what does Ezekiel say in verse 13, right after he's done describing that? He says, verse 13, he said also to me, you'll see still greater abominations that they commit. So now if you're the reader, you're thinking, what else could they possibly be doing? Well, they could be doing a lot of things, and you're going to get it here again, more specifics in the chapter. Verse 14, then he brought me to the entrance of the north gate of the house of the Lord, and behold, there sat women weeping for Tammuz. Okay, weeping for Tammuz. Now, Hebrew here when it actually refers to Tammuz. The Hebrew text here has a, sorry for the grammar spasm again, has a definite article prefixed to Tammuz, HaTammuz. And if you remember my talk about Satan in Job 1, you do not prefix a definite article to a proper personal name. You just don't do that. So this isn't actually a reference to the deity Tammuz, okay, himself, but it's certainly something connected with Tammuz, or it refers to, this is probably the best way to look at it, the ritual act, the religious act of weeping for Tammuz was well known throughout the ancient world. People wrote songs for this. They use, you know, descriptions from Mesopotamian and Sumerian stuff, and it worked its way into the Greek culture and the, you know, the Syro-Palestinian culture. There were odes to Tammuz, you know, weeping for Tammuz to commemorate, you know, Tammuz. If you don't know anything about Tammuz, I'll just give you a short reference. So the fact that they put a definite article on it refers to some specific ritual or some specific song or maybe some specific literary piece or genre, not technically to the deity himself because of the definite article. But either way, it's directed at the deity. So it's kind of like a distinction without a difference, or six of one and a half dozen of another. But again, just thought I'd point it out. Tammuz is the Hebrew form. This is from a DDD, I believe. No, this is from Harper's Bible Dictionary, the article written by Richard Clifford, who's an author I particularly like. Don't always agree with him, but he always says something useful. And Tammuz is the Hebrew form of Dumuzi, which is a Sumerian term for proper sun. Tammuz was a god widely honored from the 3rd millennium BC in Mesopotamia onward. The vast and complex Mesopotamian literature about this god shows three essential aspects of him: as lover and consort of Inanna, the goddess, as one held in the underworld and mourned because of his absence. In other words, there's this in Mesopotamian stuff, you know, Tammuz dies and then rises from the dead again. So that's why the people are mourning because of his absence. And third, as the embodiment of spring vegetation and then of vegetation in general. So Tammuz was a fertility deity, and fertility just didn't mean weird, aberrant sexual rituals. It meant fecundity for the land, for cattle, for crops, you know, that sort of thing. And that's important because you eat that stuff. That's what keeps you alive. Clifford continues, many laments are preserved that bewail the far one who has disappeared, detained in the underworld. The laments reflect the aspect of Tammuz as god of vegetation. His disappearance is connected to the drying up of the steppe in summer. His cult may have been brought to Israel by the Assyrians in the 9th and 8th centuries BC. Aspects of Tammuz became synthesized with West Semitic gods of similar characteristics. Baal Hadu, for example, went down into the underworld, died, rose, and was mourned during his absence. That's a specific reference to Baal, again, as the Canaanites knew him. Some of Dumuzi's traits also appear in Adonis, a god first attested in Greece in the 5th century BC. Ezekiel's vision of four sins being committed in Jerusalem, the temple, that's the chapter we're in, chapter 8, the third of which is a group of women weeping for Tammuz in the north gate, you know, refers to this. The women in Ezekiel are mourning this dying and rising god. The action, now catch this, here's the point that I like that Clifford observes. The action is an abomination to Ezekiel, who believes that God does not die and therefore cannot be mourned. Again, God is eternal. Again, this isn't some sort of denial, even on Clifford's part, of the incarnation and whatnot. Clifford is actually a Catholic. So, you know, he's going to go with the, you know, death, burial, resurrection of Jesus as a Catholic. He's a Catholic priest. So that isn't why he's writing this. He's just saying that for the Israelites, again, this is pre-incarnation and you know, anything that we would sort of associate, you know, with death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, you know, to an Israelite, well, God's eternal. If he's from everlasting to everlasting, he doesn't die, and so you can't mourn him. And that's what made this abominable. So it's what made it offensive, again, to Ezekiel and the rest of his people, at least those who, you know, shared his theology. Verse 15, the chapter goes on. Then he said to me, "Have you seen this, O son of man? You will still see greater abominations than these." I mean, we've been through a bunch of layers of this already. And again, God, again, the figure that took Ezekiel by the hair, God of the Spirit or whoever, brings him, you know, to this place, says, it gets worse than this. So now what's going to follow here is abhorrent for a number of reasons that are going to become apparent. It's abhorrent because of the fact that it worships the Creator as though he were part of the creation. And it's also abhorrent because it involves turning the back. The people who bow down are turning the back on the presence of Yahweh. That becomes very offensive. But let me just read. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. Let's just read verse 16 and you'll get the point here, both of them. "And he brought me into the inner court of the house of the Lord, and behold, at the entrance of the temple of the Lord," now catch that, "at the entrance of the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord." So their backs are where to the presence of God. "Their backs to the temple of the Lord, and their faces toward the east, worshiping the sun toward the east." Again, the picture is pretty evident. They're worshiping, the Hebrew term there is kavah, bowing down, la shamesh, bowing down to the sun toward the east. Now, this takes us in all sorts of different directions. Again, it's an offense to turn your back on the presence of God, but it really takes us into astral or sun cult stuff in Israelite religion. Now, I want to read a section of DDD, and I'll try to remember to tell you when I'm going in and out of this here. Most of this is going to be from DDD because it has a nice, Lipinski has a nice short article on sun worship in Israel. I'll just jump in at the beginning here. He says, "As used in the Bible, Hebrew Shemesh is never an actual divine name. It's never used as a proper personal name. Palestinian toponymy, that's the name of places, of biblical times reflects, nevertheless, the Canaanite cult of the sun god, as shown by place names like Beth Shemesh, house of the sun, En Shemesh, again, the spring of the sun, Ir Shemesh, the city of the sun, again, Beth Shemesh, Joshua 15:10, for example, En Shemesh, Joshua 15:7, Ir Shemesh, Joshua 19:41. He says, Lipinski says, all of these preserve the memory of sanctuaries devoted to the solar deity. Again, and of course, the solar deity, the sun, is worshipped very widely in the ancient Near East. So he's saying, hey, traces of this show up, again, in Canaanite cult centers that are remembered through these place names in the Hebrew Bible. He continues, surprisingly enough, Hebrew anthroponymy, those are personal names, people names. Hebrew anthroponymy does not contain obvious traces of a solar cult. Then he goes into the example of Samson. Look at the first three consonants in Samson, SMS. In Hebrew, it's Shin, Mem, Shin. And those are the three consonants for sun, Shemesh, Shamshon. Okay? So we have obvious traces of a solar, or Hebrew anthroponymy does not contain obvious traces of a solar cult. For Samson's name may simply mean little sun, as suggested by the diminutive suffix on. That's a feature of Hebrew grammar. You add on to something, that makes it little, makes it diminutive. So little sun is actually what Samson means, literally. He says, though, the Aramaic proper name Shimshai, which shows up in Ezra 4, 8, 9, and a few other places, could just mean sunny or sunlit. Shimshai, again. So he's saying there's no real clear evidence that, you know, we have a cult of sun of let me put it this way, a cult of Shamash or Shemesh, the sun god, in the Hebrew Bible, even though you have place names that associate with it. And the reason he goes into personal names is that often people would name their kids after the god they worshipped. And he's saying, look, in the Hebrew Bible anyway, you don't have any clear examples of someone naming their kid after this deity. So that's probably good evidence that the deity itself, Shamash, as a deity, was not worshipped in Israel and therefore not the object of worship here in Ezekiel 8. But the description is nevertheless idolatrous and telling for other reasons. So let's just keep going with some of the stuff that Lipinski says here. Let's just jump in here. He says, the lack of evident traces of solar worship in Hebrew anthroponymy, again, personal names, seems to indicate that the cult of the sun was not very popular in Syria-Palestine in the Iron Age, contrary to Egypt and to Mesopotamia. The sun god was a minor deity for the Phoenicians and the Aramaeans, despite the role of the Ugaritic sun goddess Shapash plays in literary and ritual texts of the late Bronze Age. The Deuteronomistic writer mentions worship of the host of heavens, comprising the sun, the moon, and the planets, or the celestial objects, only during the half of a century of the reigns of Manasseh and Amon, that's 2 Kings 21:3 and 23:5. Therefore, scholars generally suppose that this was an Assyrian astral cult which was imposed upon Judah as a symbol of subjection and vassal status. Its condemnation in Deuteronomy 4:19 and 17:3, where have you heard those verses before? Those are part of, again, the divine council, you know, worldview, that you don't bow down and worship the sun, moon, and stars. They get called Elohim. That language gets linked to Deuteronomy 32:8 and 9, the gods of the nations, okay, the sons of God, all this stuff. Lipinski says, the condemnation against worshiping the celestial objects in Deuteronomy 4:19 and 17:3 reflects the views of the same Deuteronomistic school and does not imply any older practices. So his view is basically, well, the reason why this shows up here, the reason why it was a problem in Israel is because the Assyrians, you know, as part of, again, not destroying the southern kingdom or as part of, you know, subjugating as much of the Israelite turf as they could. Remember, Judah gets saved from the Assyrian invasion. We talked a little bit about that before when we talked about the inviolability of Zion. That was the last episode last week. He's saying, you know, that Israelites, though the northern kingdom certainly was subjected to this and then eventually destroyed. And so his feeling is that, again, there's still some sort of vassalage going on here, that this astral cult found its way into, you know, the promised land area because of the Assyrians. And then again, to sort of have good relations with the Assyrians, you had Judahite kings adopt some of these worship forms. I think that makes sense. Again, that's not a unique view. What Lipinski's saying here is pretty much the standard way that scholars would look at this. Now, he has more to add that's kind of interesting. He says, the horses and chariots of the sun mentioned in 2 Kings 23:11. I might as well just look at that verse and read it to you here. This is, again, part of the campaign to weed out the worship of other gods here in 2 Kings 23. It says, he removed the horses that the kings of Judah had dedicated to the sun at the entrance to the house of the Lord by the chamber of Nathan-Melech, the chamberlain, who was in the precincts, and he burned the chariots of sun with fire. So there were actually chariots, horses and chariots of the sun in the temple compound that, again, were destroyed. And so he's saying, Lipinski says here, the horses and chariots of the sun, as well as Ezekiel's vision of the men prostrating themselves before the rising sun in Ezekiel 8:16, are somewhat different circumstance. In fact, the horses and the chariots were placed at the entrance of the temple of Yahweh, which is what we just read in the verse. And the men, now catch this, Lipinski believes that the men described by Ezekiel here were practicing their cult in the same temple facing eastwards towards the gate by which Yahweh, the God of Israel, has entered the sanctuary. Of course, that the effect, though, is still to turn his back on him because Yahweh is in the sanctuary, in the Holy of Holies. These features, Lipinski says, indicate that the sun's chariot was perceived as Yahweh's vehicle. Remember, Yahweh's the rider on the clouds. And that the men seen by the prophet were not sun worshipers, Shamash worshipers, but they were actually devotees of Yahweh, just as child sacrifice performed in the Valley of Ben-Hinnom was intended by the people who did it to honor Yahweh. again, it's aberrant worship. The people are doing certain things thinking that they're worshiping Yahweh. They presumed they were worshiping Yahweh when they bowed down to the sun. But this was contrary to Deuteronomy 4:19-20. Now, this gets even more interesting because there are vestiges of this in modern Judaism. Okay, so back to Lipinski again. He makes this comment. Relics of this ritual practice, again, they think they're worshiping Yahweh by bowing down to the sun. Like Deuteronomy 4:19-20 doesn't even exist. So it's idolatry, but the people doing it, he says, Lipinski says, they're not thinking, oh, we're bowing down to Shamash. They're thinking, oh, we're bowing down to Yahweh, and we make these chariots, you know, to the sun, because Yahweh is the sun. I mean, they're sort of worshiping the right object, but they're doing it in a horrible way. They're doing it in a forbidden way. But this carries over to modern Judaism. Listen to this. This is very interesting. Relics of this ritual practice are found, perhaps, in the blessing of the sun, the Birkat HaChama, a rabbinic prayer service in which the sun is blessed in thanksgiving for its creation and its being set in motion in the firmament on the fourth day of the world, Genesis 1:16-19. The ceremony is held once every 28 years. Most recently on the 18th of March, 1981. That tells you when the book was written. It takes place on the first Wednesday of the month of Nisan after the morning prayer, when the sun is about 90 degrees above the eastern horizon. The blessing starts with Psalm 84:12. The Lord God is a sun and shield. It's 84:11 in English order. The Lord God is a sun and shield. So that's how the prayer, the blessing starts. It's an antithetic, this is Lipinski again, it's an antithetic image that suggests that sunlight granted by the Lord and the protection he provides against heat. The prayer also contains Psalm 19, which again is, you have lines about the sun in Psalm 19. Let me just click there. Okay, the rising is from the end of the heavens, its circuit, this is about the sun. Sun is like a strong man. Its rising is from the end of the heavens, its circuit to the end of them. There is nothing hidden from its heat. So that part of Psalm 19 is in this Jewish blessing. The prayer ends with Isaiah 30:26. The light of the sun, the Or HaChama, shall be sevenfold as the light of the 7 days. Lipinski says, there can be little doubt that the sun was conceived in biblical times as a vivid symbol of Yahweh's glory. Yahweh's coming is described already in Deuteronomy 33:2 and Habakkuk 3:3-4, as the rising of the sun, and his glory comes from the east, according to Isaiah 59:19 and Ezekiel 43:2 and 44:2. While Isaiah 60:19 announces that Yahweh's glory will replace the sunlight when the new Jerusalem will arise. This solar symbolism might have represented a danger for the purity of Yahweh's worship. You think? For the sun, the moon, and the stars are even somewhat personified in Joseph's dream. Remember Joseph's dream back in Genesis 37. Job judges it necessary to profess that he never raised his hand in homage to the sun or the moon. And he even avoids using the word Shemesh, sun, replacing it by the word Or, light. So what does all this mean? Well, it means that in ancient Israel, you had Yahweh being worshipped as the sun. You had Yahweh being worshipped as a thing he had created. Very clearly, you know, Genesis describes the sun being a created thing, created by, you know, by God. And so you had Israelites, again, thinking they were worshipping Yahweh when they were violating very clear commands about worship of Yahweh, who to worship and who not to worship. So on the one hand, it's like, you know, you can kind of pat the Israelites in the back and say, oh, at least they weren't worshiping Shamash or Shemesh, the sun. Well, okay, but they were still committing idolatry. And, you know, again, Lipinski's saying, you know, that this idea, again, might have sort of kind of logical, even biblical roots, because, again, Yahweh, this language used about Yahweh that shows up in the Hebrew Bible is there. But notice that the verses about Yahweh, being associated with the sun and coming from the east and whatnot, none of those declare that he is a created being, or he is a created thing. He's part of the creation. And that was the problem, that you're worshiping, to use Paul's terminology, you're worshiping the creature instead of the creator, which is Paul's definition of idolatry. So again, even though there's sort of like biblical stuff that you could read and know what they were thinking, again, depending on when, you know, chronologically, when this or that was written, you could look at certain passages and say, oh, okay, this is what they're thinking, this is why they're doing it, it's not so bad. Well, in Ezekiel's mind, and in God's mind, because God's showing this to Ezekiel and calling it an abomination, it was bad. And I think it's a good lesson, you know, for us about, yeah, we want to worship God, but there is a way God wants to be worshiped. And there are ways God doesn't want to be worshiped. Okay, that's actually important. And it comes out in something like Ezekiel 8 in a pretty dramatic fashion. So you go through this whole list of abominations, and you know, it ends here in chapter 8 with this worshiping of the sun. In verse 17, we read, "Then he said to me, 'Have you seen this, O son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations that they commit here, that they should fill the land with violence and provoke me still to further to anger? Behold, they put the branch to their nose. Therefore, I will act in wrath. My eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, I will not hear them.'" So the chapter ends again with God basically saying, you know, again, this provokes me to anger. All of it provokes me to anger. This odd phrase about putting the branch to their nose is something, again, that's kind of interesting. I don't want to spend much time on it, but it's a very odd term. In the Targums, which is the Aramaic translation of the Hebrew Bible, the word that's substituted there or used there refers to stench. So it's kind of like all these things, instead of being a sweet-smelling savor to me, like proper worship is, you know, using the language of Leviticus, God is saying, it stinks. It just stinks. They put the branch to their nose. And that is a possible reference, not to something like a branch that had its own aroma, but I hate to put it this way, and here we go with Ezekiel being scatological again. But it could refer, again, this isn't definite, again, and it's only a supposition that scholars have because of what the Targum does with this term, Zamora. It could be a reference to basically what you wipe your butt with. And then that becomes the thing, you know, you remember that the wave offering in Leviticus, that becomes the thing that is offered to God. God says, this stinks. So again, it's very graphic, you know, potentially scatological language in Ezekiel for what God really thinks about what he's seeing, what's going on. Now, if we get into chapter 9 here, the text says, "Then he cried in my ears with a loud voice." Think about that. Here we have the speaker to Ezekiel is God. God cries in his ears with a loud voice. In other words, God screams. He's angry. He screams, but he cries in my ears with a loud voice, saying, "Bring near the executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. And behold, six men came from the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his weapon for slaughter in his hand. And with them was a man clothed in linen, with a writing case at his waist. And they went in and stood beside the bronze altar." So they go right into where the image of the creatress is. Okay. We have six guys who are executioners. There's a seventh man, a man clothed in linen. Linen, again, was typical attire for priests, but also for angelic beings. If you go to Daniel 10:5, Daniel 12:6-7, again, this is a description that you'd get of an angelic being. You know, priests and angels both are involved in divine service, you know, this whole heavenly and earthly priesthood thing. You know, Block says here, "Whether this person is a priestly figure or an angelic figure really can't be determined, though his role in the following events seems to argue for the latter." And I would tend to agree for reasons that we'll get to in a moment. I think it is an angelic figure. It's obvious from this person's equipment that his position in Jerusalem differed from that of the other six men. The other six guys are executioners. This one isn't. But this one has a writing case with him at his waist. It's actually, again, without getting too geeky here. This is a term that's borrowed from Egyptian. It refers to a scribe's writing equipment, Sofer HaKeset. It has a pen, inkhorn, wax writing tablet, whatnot, you know, those sorts of things. And it harkens back. Look at the instructions that he's given. It's going to harken back to something that I think you'll pick up on. Verse 3, now the glory of the God of Israel had gone up from the cherub on which it rested to the threshold of the house. So it's at this point when we've covered, we've got astral cults, we've got the image of the creatress, you know, we've just got a whole assortment of idolatries going on here. We've got these graven, unclean things that are being offered incense to. And God calls out the executioners and this guy with the writing case. And they position themselves, you know, right there at the altar. And then the glory moves. The glory leaves from the cherub on which it rested, to the threshold of the house. So this begins the exit out of the temple area of the glory of God. And he, God, again, the God, you know, whoever this is, the anthropomorphized God or the spirit or whoever from chapter 8, he called to the man clothed in linen who had the writing case at his waist. And the Lord said to him, now he's identified as Yahweh. The Lord said to him, again, isn't that interesting? Take that back to chapter 8. You know, again, this mixed language about, is it two beings or is it three now? And here we have the Lord, you know, specifically mentioned. Yahweh said to him, pass through the city, through Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan, in other words, who are grieved by all the abominations that are committed in it. So this harkens back to, remember we did an episode on the Book of Life? This passage actually got mentioned in passing. It refers to God keeping a record. And in this case, you have a scribe brought in, you know, an angelic or heavenly scribe, you know, clothed in linen, brought into the picture. And he's the one who's supposed to know, because he's the scribe, he's kept the records of those who are grieved by the abominations. Put a mark on them. Again, because that's going to be, it's going to be like the blood on the Passover. And I'll come back to that in a moment as well. It's going to be like the blood on the doorposts. This is going to mark them to keep them safe from what's going to happen. You know, mark those who are grieved by all these abominations. And he has a record. He's a scribe. He's the heavenly scribe. He knows what people are doing. Again, if you're interested in that subject, you can go back to that episode of the podcast and listen to it. But Taylor has a note here. He says here, there's some confusion about the actual movements of the glory of the God of Israel in this section, because at one moment he's represented by the heavenly figure on the chariot throne, while the next he's Ezekiel's personal guide. You know, too much, you know, don't, he basically says, too much accuracy is not to be expected in what was, after all, a vision. We shouldn't press it for detailed explanations. There is, however, significance in the description of the glory moving from the cherubim in verse 3, the place where the Holy of Holies, you know, where God was thought to reside, to the threshold of the house. This was the preliminary move for the final departure of the Lord from his temple. And it's from this vantage point that he starts giving directions. He says, put a mark on anybody who's faithful, who's been faithful. Now, the word mark there is Hebrew tau or tav. It is the name of the letter T, the Tav in the Hebrew alphabet. It's a sign to mark the faithful remnant. It's a sign to keep them alive, to preserve their lives, to save their lives. Of course, the fact that there's even a remnant might be surprising given what we just read in Ezekiel 8 and before that, but there is. Now, I don't want to make too much about this sign, but it is kind of interesting. In Old Hebrew, not the block Hebrew that you're familiar with seeing today, block Hebrew, the tav looks like kind of a doorway with a little appendage on one leg at the bottom. That's what a tav looks like. In Old Hebrew, though, it was an X, or as people like to say, it was the sign of the cross. That's what it was. You crossed two lines. You made an X. You crossed two lines, and that became known, you know, in later times as a cross, because the lines were crossed. And that was just the way you wrote the Old Hebrew letter Tav, T. Taylor says here, early Christian commentators were quick to notice that in the oldest Hebrew script, the letter was written as an X, as a cross. To the Hebrew reader, though, This meant nothing more than a mark used for a signature. And there's a biblical reference to that, believe it or not. In Job 31:35, we read this. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my signature. And in Hebrew it says, here is my tav. Here's my mark. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. So, again, to an Israelite, this is like sign here and you put an X. Okay? That's your mark. But again, the shape of it was noticed again by early Christians. You know, as obviously maybe this is analogous to what happens at the cross. Now, I don't want to make too much of that, but I also don't want to dismiss it because of you have this guy in linen who's the scribe, again, who's keeping track of who's been faithful here. And he's going to mark them with the tav, with the cross, to save their lives, to protect them. And you're going to have a term used when the killing starts, when the destruction starts, mashkit, okay, destruction. Also could be translated the destroyer in certain passages. That is the term used of the death angel at the Passover event. And so I do think that there is, again, a conceptual analogy here between being marked by the tav, marked by the cross, and the blood being applied so that destruction was avoided or so that destruction passed over you. And we all know, in New Testament theology, there is a direct equation, a direct analogy made between the effect of what Jesus did and the passing over the blood. Passing over that house at the Passover, because the blood had been applied to that place. And so I do think, again, this is a case. I'm trying to think of who it is. It's Block or somebody that says, again, we don't want to make too much of it, but this might be one of those places where the Old Testament writer kind of wrote something that he may not have been specifically aware of, but it's a significant foreshadowing. There's more depth to it. It's typology. There's more typological depth, typological theology going on here than people could have realized at that point. I do think there's something to that here, again, because of the terminology that follows. So let's just get into what follows here. So you know, he's commanded to put a mark on these guys, those who are grieved at the abominations. Verse 5, chapter 9, to the others he said in my hearing, pass through the city after him and strike. Your eyes shall not spare. You shall show no pity. Kill old men outright, young men and maidens, little children, women, but touch no one on whom is the mark. And begin at my sanctuary. You're going to begin with the priests, you know, the state sponsorship stuff. So they began with the elders who were before the house. Then he said to them, defile the house, fill the courts with the slain, go out. Because again, that was a defilement of sacred space, a corpse, as we studied in Leviticus. So they went out and struck the city. And while they were striking, and I was left alone, I fell on my face. Ezekiel says, I fell on my face and cried, ah, Lord God, will you destroy? There's the mashkit here. Will you destroy all the remnant of Israel in the outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem? Now, on one level, it's pretty plain, you know, what's going on here. Ezekiel has this vision, you know, all these people are being destroyed. What's the basis of their destruction? They didn't grieve over the abominations. Okay. They were somehow, and you say, well, how would they know? Well, folks, this is a divine scribe. Again, God knows who was grieved over the idolatry and who was not. Okay. That's a fundamental point. You know, in the passage, because that's the basis for the decision. At another level, this is an allegory for what Nebuchadnezzar and his men are going to do, and what they actually did do. Okay, in destroying Jerusalem, destroying the city. Now, the question that we have to ask is this really this episode? Is it really an indication that all of the righteous? There apparently weren't a whole lot of them. But is this an indication that all of the righteous were spared in Nebuchadnezzar's invasion? You know, it's kind of hard to tell. I don't know how far we should press this vision in a one-to-one equation you know, to what actually happened with Nebuchadnezzar. And again, God, like in Ezekiel 6, God said, I'm going to use the worst of nations to punish you. You know, can we press this to say that all those people who avoided idolatry were spared? I don't know. Maybe. I wish it were that clear. It could be that case if the use of a term like mashkit, again, which takes us directly, mentally, theologically, conceptually back to the Passover event. If that telegraphing is theologically intentional, then you probably could argue that if you were not guilty of idolatry, you were spared in the last wave of Nebuchadnezzar's invasion. Now, you might still get deported, okay, to Babylon. Lots of Jews were deported in the third wave. Maybe you got left behind. Who knows? Maybe you were able to hide, or, you know, who knows? Who knows what's going on in real time here? But again, you could make that argument if these analogies are intentional. And again, I kind of think that they are, because, you know, I think the use of the linen, again, that's not just priestly, it's angelic. The whole idea of God knowing who's doing what, I don't think that's a normal priest. I think it's an angelic priest, because of all the other passages that deal with God keeping records and using angels again to be the divine accounting system, if you want to use a metaphor like that. Plus the reference to Mashkit, the destroying angel. Again, I think some of these things are sufficient to telegraph the point that God, in this last invasion, spared the faithful. There weren't many of them, but there was a faithful remnant. Now you say, well, Ezekiel here says here, are you going to destroy the whole faithful or the whole remnant? Again, remember back in earlier episodes when we talked about the remnant, it can be used of different groups and subgroups. So that's not necessarily an argument against what I'm saying. I'm just telling you where I'm at on the passage. I think you can make that argument. So to wrap up here, the chapter ends this way. Then he said to me, again, God speaking to Ezekiel, the guilt of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. The land is full of blood and the city full of injustice. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the land and the Lord does not see. As for me, my eye will not spare, nor will I have pity. I will bring their deeds upon their heads. And behold, the man clothed in linen with the writing case at his waist brought back word saying, I have done as you commanded me. Again, you know, we got the full picture here. It's not feel-good stuff. And because, hey, it's Ezekiel, and we have, you know, it's judgment. It's going to be judgment up to a certain point, and then Ezekiel's going to transition, you know, to comforting those who are left. And so it's more the same we've been seeing in Ezekiel. I think the two big takeaways here are, again, that, you know, God can and does and has and will decide to judge wickedness. He will decide to judge evil. You know, we can look at these passages and say, well, this is just random. It's, you know, there's nothing. It's willy-nilly, capricious deity. And all. It's not capricious. The standard was mark those who are in grief over what's going on. Okay. You can go, well, what about the kids? Again, you can look at the terminology. It doesn't have to refer to infants and whatnot. I mean, you can argue about this, you know, till you're blue in the face. You know, there is a measure. There's a standard for accountability here. And so that's what we need, you know, we need to look at as far as the text. God knows. What better authority would there be? God knows who approved of idolatry. Again, the language, again, we can, you know, argue about that, but you can argue both sides of it. But I think the contextual indications are that God knows who was grieved with what was going on and who wasn't. God is the best judge. He's omniscient. He knows. He's not guessing. And that becomes the basis, again, for what God is going to allow to happen with Nebuchadnezzar in this last wave of the conquest. And the second takeaway, I think, is this note about improper worship. They thought, at least some of them, I mean, if you're worshiping, if you're dancing around the Asherah pole, okay, it's kind of hard to justify that. Even if you say, well, that's Yahweh's wife, you know, he wouldn't be mad. Well, yeah, he would, because it's not him. Okay, he doesn't share his glory with another. So that's a little hard, but you could look at them bowing down to the sun, thinking they're worshiping Yahweh. Again, you must ignore other commands about creating graven images, worshiping the creature over the creator, all that sort of stuff. It was idolatry. It's what it is. Even though it was well-intentioned, the worship, we'll give them the benefit of the doubt and we'll assume it was well-intentioned. Even though that could be the case, God was still angry about it. He didn't accept it. It was, by definition, unacceptable. So again, I think we need to keep these things in mind again for the way, we do things. Just to remind ourselves, look, what we do matters. Okay, how we express our loyalty to God matters. Of course, who we assign loyalty to, believing loyalty, matters. But again, the way we express that also matters.
All right, Mike. Well, that was a jam-packed episode, and you had some help with your dogs in the background there for a little bit. So,
yeah, I heard Maury. He's upset about something.
I don't know. He's probably mad at you. All right. Well, for the sake of time, Mike, do you have anything else you would like to add real quick? I know next week we're going to be doing another Q&A episode.
Then we'll jump back in, I think, with two chapters. Next time we return to Ezekiel, it'll be two chapters, 10 and 11.
All right, Mike. Well, I just want to remind everybody, if you have it, please go on iTunes or wherever you listen to us and give us a little rating or a review if you don't mind. And I want to thank Mike for another good episode, and thank you all for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.